have a model that it has cost and value. And so the value that someone has in their life and in their business, that it comes through your experience, that comes through your training, that comes through your education, that how you've resourced yourself, the connections that you have. Like, what type of value can you bring to the marketplace?
My friends, and welcome back to the Business of Homes podcast. I'm Michael Conrad, your host, and today I'd like to take you on a bit of a journey about a subject that I think is so important but complex, and that is around innovation and how innovation intersects with the free market. Today, I'm lucky enough to have Jonathan Harris of Scout Realty here, and Jonathan and I have known each other off and on for a lot of years. And he is someone who, from afar, I have seen adeptly create a new and separate and interesting brand and continue to innovate over and over in a field that largely is devoid of innovation outside of big tech these days. And so I'm hoping that we can dig a little into Jonathan and kind of what makes him tick and how he continues to generate these new ideas and what his experience has been in doing all of this stuff. So Jonathan, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it, Michael.
When we met, you were carefully crafting and gathering experience. And I don't know if I knew it at the time, but as I look back on your journey from brokerage to brokerage, and then of course starting your own, it felt like you had made this choice to be with an established brand very intentionally. Is that true? Tell me about that. Where was that the on-ramp into real estate right away into Friedrich & Clark, or did you start elsewhere?
In college, I bought my first house. I lived off campus. It was a stated income no-doc loan. And so I went into the bank. I said, this is a house I want to buy. They said, do you make around $50,000 or whatever it was, $60,000? I'm like, I don't. And they're like, but could you? And I'm like, I mean, I guess I could, but I probably couldn't. I'm just a college student. And they're like, oh, that's good enough. We'll give you a loan. So I filled it up with renters and I made about $400 a month in cash flow. And I thought, man, this is crazy. I'm making money on a house that I own that I didn't pay anything for. I didn't put any money down. Stated income, no DACA loans, no down payment. That's why the mortgage industry had busted. But when in college, that's what got me into it. And then I started buying and selling houses with these stated income, no doc loans. And I started flipping houses. So I wasn't doing too good in school, but I was doing pretty good at buying and selling houses. I got my license. My uncle said, man, if you're going to be buying and selling all your own houses, and I had done about 50 transactions on my own without an agent, I got my license after that. And I'm thankful I did, because the 2008 bubble, when it burst, it was very, very, very painful for me. But I had my license, and some friends said, hey, can you help us find a house? And I said, yeah, absolutely. I've never helped anybody before, but I had helped myself several times. And then they referred a client and they referred a client. It just kind of snowballed from there. So there was never a goal or intention to get into the real estate industry by way of being an agent. It was accidental. I was just getting it to service my own business. I needed it to help my clients whenever the bubble burst. And so I kind of woke up in 2012 and realized, okay, I never chose to become an agent. It was kind of one of those things just to have it out of convenience. I've personally experienced buying and selling houses about 50 transactions without having an agent. So like, do I really need an agent? You know, in some cases I could say absolutely not. I've experienced having a great run without representation. So I've kind of seen both sides of the fence. I got my real estate license. Worked in a traditional brokerage, and there were some needs that I had as an agent that just were not being met in the traditional brokerage. And so I reluctantly started a business, not because I wanted to be a business owner, but I was trying to solve my own problems. And I fundamentally believe, like, if you can solve your own problems in some method, you may be able to solve someone else's problems who has the exact same issues that you do.
I think that is literally how every therapist becomes a therapist. They're trying to fix themselves. Yeah. And they're thinking, maybe I can fix some other people too.
Probably so.
Well, hold on, we got to back up here, because you've dropped a couple really interesting facts that some of these listeners are going to have their minds spin on. So I got to make sure we're getting the right story here. You had done 50 transactions prior to the recession, largely without an agent.
Without an agent altogether.
And, you know, the age of Google was in its infancy back then. And so was this complete trial and error? Were you using TAR contracts? I mean, how did you navigate that?
I had a one-page contract that I just literally typed up.
I want your house.
Yeah. I would keep it in my car and I would drive. I had a pretty good target area that I knew the mailman. I'd pay the mailman $50 for every lead that he would give me. If he knew somebody's going to a nursing home or somebody's planning on moving, any forwarding mail, he'd bring me addresses and I'd pay him $50 and I'd go track down the homeowner wherever they lived, knock on their door and say, you own a house in this neighborhood or your loved one? I'm interested in buying it. So, I mean, I was just bird dogging. I would hustle. I had a one-page contract and I made things happen. And I had more friction points in the transactions whenever agents got involved. Mm.
So it is interesting because throughout, I would say, well, the last 25 years, which I think is more easier to talk about than anything else, the last 25 years, we've seen a rise in agents who are not necessarily owners or investors themselves because the real estate agent lifestyle is more visually on display. We're more aware of it. I think some of the older stigmas around who were real estate agents, you know, it's not the 80s, you know, and it's like your mom's friend or whatever. So this is a really interesting entry point because it's actually a moderately rare entry on ramp into the market, that which is a very experienced purchaser, seller, investor type becomes then an agent. Because in a lot of ways, I think that we forget that these worlds are not easily overlapped. Those that own or invest is not 100% overlap with those that sell or list or whatever. Right. What's been your experience on that?
Yeah, I think it's embarrassing. I think there's a danger report in 2015 or 16, I believe, that NAR, National Association of Realtors, put out. And it has basically 160 some odd pages in the danger report. The very first main point, A1, is the real estate industry is saddled with untrained, unethical, unprofessional, and it undermines the credibility of the agent base in the marketplace. And I completely agree with that. I mean, why would an industry allow people to get their license in 2 weeks? That's crazy. Like, you can get your license in no time flat and then represent people in their most important purchase. It's weird that's allowed. You look at an appraisal industry, you need to go through an apprenticeship program. So our industry kind of harbors and attracts weak and uncommitted people. I mean, in my experience, I mean, 21 years, I've seen this. The amount of agents that have come into the industry, I would say this in a blanket statement, they're pretty much unemployable. Like, they couldn't get a job anywhere else because they want the freedom and the flexibility and the lifestyle. And that has really become what our industry has happened over the last several years through the age of social media. Everybody wants to look the part, act the part, go in the beautiful kitchens, and it's just become a style-oriented business and something that's aspirational and like, how do I look and how to appear? We're in a service-based industry. You're here to get on your knees and wash feet. You're here to serve humanity. You're here to make their experience faster, easier, more affordable, better. And so I just don't see that the agent community has that grit and determination of like, I'm going to be awesome. I'm going to be the best. I'm going to be well-trained. I'm going to subject myself to a 40-hour disciplined work week because my clients deserve it.
Yeah.
So coming into the industry after about 50 transactions with no license, and I come into the industry, I'm like, man, this is weak. There's a lot of reformation that needs to happen. And so I think that's why we have the consumer's pushback and reaction to the agent lifestyle and the agent and the cost benefit or cost value exchange of like, what am I paying and what am I getting?
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation with someone a while back, and they were presenting this idea that there are units of value that we struggle to term, but I think we know it in our gut. And that is, if someone is a provider of goods or services, then we sort of internally begin to make these judgments and formulas about, well, what was the time that went into being capable to provide that good or service? What was the time that went into actually building or curating that good or service? And so we think about everything from, you know, McDonald's employees to, you know, roofers and plumbers to neurosurgeons and attorneys. And the amount of time, there's sort of a before you begin the service or good, there's the amount of time, the lead up,
sure,
education.
Medical's 10 years, attorneys are 4 years.
Right.
real estate agents by the hour get paid more money for 2 weeks.
Right.
Facts.
Then there is the actual provision of service. The number of hours you're performing a brain surgery, the number of hours it takes to fix a water heater, whatever it is.
And it's the opportunity cost. Could I have got this somewhere else for better or for less?
Yes. And the free market dynamics in, I would say, real estate sales have not fallen in a traditional free market downward pressure on, you know, pricing and competition sort of thing. It's been a little different, but we all have this gut feeling that tells us, well, could I do it myself? Could I learn in a quick or relatively efficient manner, sure, to sort of to replace that good or service in my life? Like, does buying bread or making my own bread, where's the cost benefit analysis? And there is this number of units of effort, and we all have it, right? And which is why if someone ever were to tell us, oh, well, this lawyer charges $15 an hour, something in our gut would tell us, oh, that something is wrong there. Because if that person either knew what they were talking about and had the sufficient experience to call themselves that and were sufficiently licensed, certified, whatever, then it would be different. And I don't know if I can tell you why, maybe some people might say, but it would be different. And so one of two conclusions then comes about, and that is either they don't know what they're talking about, or they are running an unsustainable and unhealthy practice or business that, you know, isn't worth linking up with. And so this paradigm then, as we look at real estate, gets a little upside down, whether it's wholesalers or listing agents or buyer's agents, you know, just across the board. If you are in the conveyance of real estate, there is a lead up, education and experience, and there is a provision of service, the time you spend to do it. And is it commensurate with what's paid out? And I think that the system we're in has organically led us here based on percentages and commissions. But of course, the history of cost of things has been wildly different. And so it's not exactly equal in some respects.
Yeah. I remember 2010 or 11, there was a client that I was working with, and he said, and the husband and wife were business owners. They were super sharp, Vanderbilt grads. They were buying at that time a very expensive house. It was like 1.8. At that time, that was
massive.
And we were in the car, and I remember him said, he said, "Hey, tell me something. What type of training have you had around negotiation?" I said, "Training around negotiation?" He's like, "Surely to goodness, to get your license, you would have gone through like a negotiation course, or does your brokerage, do they have a course that you train on negotiation?" I was like, "No, actually not."
Do you have a debate team?
And he said, what gives you the authority, or what gives you the privilege to be able to charge what you're charging when you've never taken formal training around negotiation? Like, how are you even qualified to represent me if you've never even had to go that to get your license?
Yeah.
I said, that's a fair question. And now that you're asking it, yeah, that is pretty strange. I don't know, but I can say that because I've had maybe 50 transactions on my own, I've had to do surgery on myself 50 times, I've learned a thing or two. And I think that maybe I could take those trial and errors and learnings on myself and apply it to you. But as you say that, I think that's very strange, because this was earlier in my career as far as having my license. I thought, man, I can't believe that I wasn't made to go through some sort of formal training or apprenticeship or having someone look over my shoulder. That was, so you start to have, what can we say, like this cost and value, is it commensurate? I have a model that it has cost and value. And so the value that someone has in their life and in their business, that it comes through your experience, that comes through your training, that comes through your education, that how you've resourced yourself, the connections that you have, like what type of value can you bring to the marketplace? Then is cost. Cost and value are mutually exclusive. They're definitely not the same thing at all. What you choose to charge someone is not doesn't have anything to do with your value. Like, I'll give you an example. Derrick Henry last summer, I saw that he had a kids football camp, and he was charging $50 for the inner city kids to come. $50. I was like, man, that's really cool. It's on News Channel 2. Derrick Henry's football camp, $50. But he's getting paid $20 million, whatever his contract is. He's worth more than $50. Does him charging $50 make him less valuable?
Devalue him.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, no.
So what you choose to charge someone does not make you more valuable. what you choose to charge someone anything less does not make you worth less. Like, your identity has to be rooted in something much different than what you charge. So you have value and cost at mutually exclusive terms. What you're worth, because I hear agents all the time say, oh, I'm worth my commission. I'm worth it. No, you're not. And I'll say no, you're not to every single agent who's listening to this. If you're listening to this, you're not worth it. And here's why. The consumer assigns value to something. They say it's worth it to me. So when you go into any store and you buy any product, why did you not buy everything that you saw? Because there's something that says that was worth it to me, that's not worth it to me, that's worth it to me. So when agents start to kind of beat the drum of I'm worth it, it's not your judgment to call. It's the consumer's job to assign value. And if they cannot quickly and easy recognize the value that you create and that there's a disproportionate exchange of value and cost, that they get more than they pay for it. That's how you create a repeat customer. 89% of all people do not use the agent that they sold the house with. Yeah. If your value and cost were so aligned and the customer receives so much value relative to the, they would absolutely continue to come to you.
Yeah, so this is wonderful. I mean, take a note here, everyone. Pause, go back, listen to that again. And then when you get to this point, again, pause, go back, listen for a third time. Because value and worth have a interconnection, but they are not intrinsic. They are not at a core DNA level. It is something that is developed. It is something that is arguable and can be debated. And the absolute truth is that we don't have intrinsic value natively when we start out the gate. It's built around what you're able to provide, what you know, what your experience is in. And going back a few minutes of what you just said, no one of those things is the magic bullet. You can't get a gajillion hours of education and suddenly become perfectly qualified, valuable, and full of worth. You can't get a ton of hours of experience. I hear this in the trades world a lot where, well, I've been doing something 40 years. Well, you might have been doing something 40 years wrong. So experience is only a part of the puzzle. And knowledge isn't enough too. You have to be able to weave these things together. And so you're getting into these lovely, really fascinating essential business principles. And that is value and worth is basically an agreed upon thing between two parties.
I would say worth is almost like a vote. Someone says, you know what? I see the value. I recognize the cost. I'm going to assign worth to the product or service. And I'm going to say, I'm going to vote to say yes. Think about a Lexus car commercial in the drive to December or whatever it is. And why does everyone not drive Lexuses? Because a lot of people could probably buy a Lexus that are not driving a Lexus because to them, it's deeply personal. It's not worth it to me to go drive a brand new Lexus. I don't care how many commercials I get worn out with on December. It's not worth it to me because I have a different vision for my life or a different vision for my family. Some people say it's worth for if I have an opportunity cost to spend money, I'm going to send my kid to private school versus drive a Lexus. So it's not worth it at the expense of sending them to private school. So worth is a deeply personal thing. The service provider has to harden themselves and say, I'm going to enrich myself and create massive amounts of valuable that's latent potential that can be deployed to bring a service to someone. Then I get the choice of what I choose to charge that person. Then I have to like sit back and say, is it worth it to them? Do they give me that vote? And listen, if you don't get the vote, it's feedback. And I used to do this in real estate. Anytime I would see someone list a house, I'd be Facebook friends with them. They list the house and I'd call them and say, hey, listen, you could give me an incredible gift and feedback. You could teach me a lesson. There's something I'm missing here. I saw that your house was listed and I'm just curious, what could I have done to earn your listing?
Yeah.
Because there's an issue of value there. Like the value was not enough for them to say
they made their choice. They made their vote.
They cast the vote for someone else. And that is an incredible strategy for any agent. If you're listening to this, anytime you don't get a listing, whether you know the person, whether you got beat on a listing presentation, whether you saw somebody that you know listing, don't get mad. Don't get bitter. Get better. Like go in like Sherlock Holmes mode and go and to discover what could I have done. Sometimes there is a misperception of value. Sometimes they just were not aware of what you do. I mean, I remember I called one of my best friends earlier in my career. I'm like, hey man, why didn't you use me? He's like, oh man, I totally forgot you in real estate. So here's the feedback. You can't be an undercover agent. Like, you have to be like known about what value you create in the marketplace. So I think that pursuing feedback, and when someone does not cast a vote for you, learn from it. And sometimes people are like, oh, that agent this and that agent this, or you get what you pay for. If they're a discount broker, whatever the narrative is about why you got beat, why don't you get curious and ask them and listen? Yeah. Don't talk, listen.
So you're intersecting with a part of this conversation around building a company image and a brand. And in branding, it's one piece of this effectively, I think you're talking about a conversation. Yeah. The brand is this is my value. And your unique selling points, your USPs, oftentimes are the supportive structure that says, and this is how I defend my value or how I prove it out. But that's really just you shouting into the canyon. If there is that vote backwards, that conversational element of two parties saying, this is my value, this is my brand, this is what I'm worth, I'm visible, I'm not visible, I have experience in luxury, I don't, you know. The vote on the other side is the other half. You have to hear the responsive quality to that, and they have to agree to it. Just because you say, I know this neighborhood, or I am good in this way, or I'm experienced in this way, doesn't mean anyone agrees to you. And even if you do have some sort of number of notches in your belt, it may be irrelevant. And so that vote, that responsive quality, and that larger sort of value conversation is so important. But you have to be able to shape up and really present your brand best foot forward, defending your values, not in a pre-defensive kind of way, but in a, quite honestly, a lovely mix of both humility and confidence. And then you have to wait for those votes of yes. And if you get those in accidental silences or votes of no, you have to be able to tease it out. And we had a great episode with Kaylin Evans about that exact thing, chasing down the person that didn't give you the listing and saying, I'll pay you to tell me why.
This is a lesson. This is a tuition. Like yes. I need to know why you did not choose me. I
love that.
So it applies to sellers as well. They have an opinion of cost, or they think their house is worth this number. Mm. Okay. You choose a listing price is different than a sales price. I care a lot more about a sales price than a list price. And so whenever a seller says, no, my house is worth $800,000, and the agent's like, oh God, it may have been $800,000 like in 2021 in multiple offer, like we'd be hard pressed to get $750,000 now. Let's go for it. You're 60 days on the market, 90 days on the market. Hey, I think we need a price reduction. Just take the feedback for what it is. The market has rejected you. The market has said you're not worth $800,000. And so, you know, I've just kind of learned is like, I don't take opinions of value from anybody who's not willing to write a check. So if the agent says, oh, I think the house is worth this, or a seller says, oh, I think my house is worth this, your opinion doesn't count. It does not matter because you're not the one that's writing a check. We have to learn what the marketplace assigns to the value of the house. Yeah, but I'm in this neighborhood, I'm in this school zone, I've done these types of upgrades, I need this much.
It's not intrinsic.
It does not matter.
Yeah.
It's a very personal opinion to the consumer. So you have to be open to receive feedback. For everyone can be your teacher.
Okay, hashtag masterclass. Folks listening here, this is basically free market economics.
100%.
101. This is Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. There will be a rewarding of those that have created a proper formulaic value, and there will be a punishment of those that fail to do so. And so that is a good word. And I'm even thinking of myself. I have no intention of selling my house right now, but I'm sort of imagining myself doing it right now. And what's the words I'm going to say to some agent? And what's the word I'm going to say to some future buyer? I think I need to be thinking there is no intrinsic value, which then leads me to an interesting next step. And that is, what then can I do to my asset to create the highest possible opportunity for a mutual yes between two parties, which is a sale?
Yeah. To me, there's a process of discovery. Mm. We will learn together what the marketplace assigns to the value of the
house. It's iterative, actually.
It is.
It's not
very dynamic.
Presentational. This is what it is.
Yeah. You know, I have seven principles that I think over 21 years, and I'll take a step back. My dad was a broker in the 70s and 80s. So my job when I was 5 years old was to trade out the MLS books. So I was in a real estate office my entire life. So my perspective is when there was one MLS book for the month for the entire office with a black and white photograph in my dad's office, oh, he would be very upset if anyone took the only MLS book out of the office because everyone needs this book. So, I mean, I'm looking back like almost my entire life in residential real estate. That being said, is I've got seven principles that I work off of whenever I think through real estate. One of those principles is real estate market is self-correcting. The marketplace will not allow you to sell your house until you reach fair market value or true market value. Think of it like a ball floating on the water, like a beach ball on the pool. There is a water table and the ball will always land on the water table. So in a free market, if you list it too high, the market will force you to have price reductions to either meet the market or you will have to wait it out until the market meets you.
Right. Inertial pressure.
Yes. So there is a time, like when do you want to sell your house? I mean, because let's say that you live in Creve Hall and you're like, man, I really want $1 million for my house. You know what? There's really not a lot of houses in Creve Hall that could even touch $1 million right now, but I guarantee in 20 years, every house will be worth $1 million.
Time and price are intersecting 100%. Lines on a graph. And we have to know
when do you want to sell your house?
What's
is the question.
Your pressure? Yeah.
When do you want to sell your house? If you want to sell your house by May, okay, that's a different strategy than I want to sell my house in 10 years. So just as if you want to sell your house, hey, I want to have my house sold by the end of the day. I can sell your house by the end of the day for $100.
Okay. So another way to put this to help our listeners here is that time and price are levers and they are interrelated in a proportional or inversely proportional sense.
So
rather.
The intersection is the offer. The intersection is when a buyer, a willing and able buyer and a willing and able sayer come to a yes. There's a yes agreement. And when I think about the buyer, when they come to the property, if the property's too high, they say, I reject it. I will not make an offer. Because sellers always want feedback. Hey, what's feedback? Feedback is only price. There's no other feedback except for price. Price moves everything.
You sold it too soon. No, that's not the feedback.
Yes. So it'll force you to come down. But also the market, if you list it too low, the market will disallow you to sell it too low. It will force the price up in a multiple offer situation. I think the only way that you can screw up the market dynamics is you either elongate the time in which someone could buy it. So like, hey, we're not going to sell this house for 30 days. Place your offer. You got 30 days to wait and see if you got it. You could lose some people. But also in 2 days, we'll make you a full price offer right now if you take it. You might have been able to hold out a couple more days and let it be introduced to a few more buyers. You might have sold it too low. So I think that real estate markets are self-correcting. You underprice it, it will get bid up. You overprice it, it will have to come down.
Yeah, Grant Hammond and I were talking a while back, and he said, people like to think that there's all these mitigating factors of what sells real property. And there is, in fact, only one and a lot of other footnotes. And the one thing is price.
Price. It's the greatest marketing tool you have available.
I hate that reality because I spend, as a tradesperson in the larger landscape, I spend a lot of time trying to direct the conversation away from price because it is an oversimplified way of understanding value and worth. However, when it comes to real property, we don't have to hurt the feelings of the house. It has a more specific price that's going to follow market dynamics than, say, free market in the service world.
If you ever watch Shark Tank,
yeah,
the person comes in, they want to invest in their business, and they'll say, I'm willing to give up 10% of my business for $100,000. If there's only one shark left standing, that dude's given up a lot more than 10% of his business.
The pressure's on.
There's only one. But whenever there's five sharks bidding for the business, hey, I'll do it for 8%. I'll do it for 7%. I'll give you, no percentage in a royalty. I'll double, they start to get really creative. So who wins? The guy that came in that, in a sense, he undervalued underpriced his property or underpriced his company to where there was a feeding frenzy. The one manipulative tool is buyer's emotion. There is a trigger of competition. There's a trigger in transparency that things can happen in that environment that can never happen in just a stagnant environment. So, whenever you list a house, I mean, to me, you don't have to be that good at looking at comps. I'd rather create competition and let the competition inform the value. Just put a no-brainer price on there and let the competition duke it out. Then for the seller to then show up and say, this is what I'm willing to do.
So this is hard if you stand back, not as a 20-year practitioner of real estate, but if you stand back as a consumer who lives another mental life and doesn't think about these things. We tend to put real property in the place, in the bucket of consumer goods, because we do so much purchasing of consumer goods, both large and small, from cars down to, you know, toasters, that we think that value follows a more formulaic sense of like manufacturing or time or inflation or whatever. But there are greater issues at play in real property. And so people aren't recognizing that just a larger dynamic at play. And so I think this is really hard for your modern consumer to wrap their minds around this. And the process feels very straightforward. Oh, I am going to use a comp and I'm going to use an appraisal to assign value. But I think that those are really, well, first of all, they are backwards trend looking examinations.
It's like driving down the road. If I drove here today.
But you only look backwards on the road.
And I only looked in the rearview mirror to get here.
Yeah.
I have an indication of kind of the environment around me because I'm looking at the rearview mirror, but I probably will have a wreck if I'm not looking through the windshield. Anybody who lists a house, you don't know how many buyers are in the marketplace. You don't know how many buyers have auto notification set up. You don't know how many buyers are pre-approved. You don't know how many ready, willing. So everything is guesswork and just an assumption. I think that in our need, and I think this is more like a human nature survival, you need to feel right. You need to feel certain. You need to feel absolute. I think it's human nature to feel a little off whenever you don't, when you have ambiguity. For me as a practitioner, it's like, I don't know. Anybody who tells you they know doesn't know what they're talking about. That is a very prideful person who thinks they know. I don't know how many buyers there are, but I know how to discover and surface a buyer. There is a methodology for us to do this.
Yeah. And again, with the levers that are sort of moving at different rates, if you can possibly manage time as a more flexible factor in your formula, you will end up almost certainly more likely happy about price. But oftentimes we are not good about putting in appropriate buffers of time in to achieve price goals, or maybe we don't even know what the price goals are. And so we don't know how much mitigating time we need. But just as a general rule of thumb, if price is a concern, and it always is, when you're buying or selling, then you have to have time be a mitigating factor. Give yourself more time so that you can achieve those more specific price goals.
Mm-hmm. There's a guy that I'd gone to a conference of his, Russell Brunson, and he talked about basically, there was a marketing conference, and there's three things in marketing. And the first one was, what is your bold claim? The second thing is, what is your irresistible offer? And your third is, what's your risk reversal? So when we talk about pricing and time and like, oh my gosh, like I need absolutes. I need to kind of have I need $700,000 out of this house, or I need to have it gone in the end of a month. I think for innovators, for people who obsess about creating the future that aren't so much wanting just to play someone else's game, they want to like literally build what's to come. I think coming up with formulas or recipes to saying, this is my bold claim. I can sell any house in Nashville in 30 days or less. I'm just using this example, or I have a methodology or I have a formula to produce this predictable result in no uncertain terms. Here is a hook. If I can't do it, I'll pay you $1,000 in 30 days if I fail you. Oh, that's pretty, that's a risk reversal. So what bold claims do you make around your service? What irresistible offers? Like there's a guy named Alex Ramosi, I think is a genius. He talks about making offers that anyone would feel dumb saying no.
Right.
Okay, what's the offering? And then how do you de-risk it for someone? So their mental leap of like, okay, you're telling me to price my house low, but like, I don't know, like what if that really hurts us? So there's a risk associated with that. There are plenty of thought exercises that you can put in to say, okay, here starts to become my cocktail or my business offering of my bold claim, my irresistible offer, and the risk reversal that I can package in a way to attract customers where they can easily and quickly recognize it's worth it. I tell you what, in 31 days, if that doesn't work, I know the benefit. 31 days it does work, I know the benefit. So you've taken a customer and you've kind of moved them across what I would call the epiphany bridge, is who they are today or where they are today and where they want to go or where you want them to go tomorrow. How do you take them across this epiphany bridge where the lights come on, they say, this is my decision, this is the best decision for me?
Hey everyone, it's Jake, director for the Business of Homes podcast. I hope you've been enjoying today's episode, starting with Jonathan's many moves before becoming Scout's CEO, how clients interpret the cost benefits of agents, and how the worth of an agent is more like a vote. When we return, Michael and Jonathan dive into how guilt plays into the decision of choosing a realtor, how real estate hasn't changed much in 100 years, and shifting focus from style and image to substance. You don't want to miss it. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Business of Homes Pod, where you can interact with us and see some great bite-sized pieces from all of our episodes. For you listeners out there, did you know our entire podcasts are filmed and are on our YouTube channel? Check it out next time you want to see our amazing guests tell their stories. And are you currently watching this episode in video format? Don't forget to follow us on your preferred audio streaming service to take us with you on the go. Lastly, do you have any feedback or want to suggest someone for the show? Email us at thebusinessofhomespodcast@gmail.com. Please enjoy the rest of today's episode with Jonathan Harris. Let's get back to it.
I passed several Mark Spain billboards on the way here. Guaranteed offer. Props to that guy. He doesn't even live in Tennessee. He lives, I think, in Georgia. He came in here in fall of 2019 with those billboards. I think last year he did like 1,800 houses in Middle Tennessee. He had a compelling offer that the audience, a segment of audience, was called out and responded to the offer.
And I got to be honest, I didn't think it would work.
Oh, he smoked
it. I judged it because I said, that is a hollow offering because you're not getting overly specific in which to communicate the value from the billboard, which was very intentional. He wanted the conversation opportunity. And so people called because they were curious of what that was. What is the offer?
And that's the brilliance of Zillow's Zestimates. Agents hate Zestimates. They make fun of Zillow's for Zestimates, but agents do not understand marketing. If you cannot create a conversation, you have no opportunity to sell. You have to create a conversation, whether it's Guaranteed Offer by Mark Spain. I'm curious enough to call, which create a conversation that gives them a different opportunity to sell, or the Zestimate. I'm just curious what my house is worth. Even if it's wrong, it doesn't matter. It creates a conversation. So, to me, the next generation agents are agents who deeply understand marketing. How do you create a customer? Because Mark Spain did not have relationship selling on who does he know, like, and trust. He had value. He had a hook. He had a core offering that people said yes to. Not everyone, but a segment. And that's made him a lot of money.
It's really countercultural. I mean, I've had a lot of conversations on this podcast alone about people really banging the drum and flying the flag of know, like, and trust as the way forward. And it is interesting because
that knife cuts both ways, because if you don't have the strongest relationship at the point in which a decision is being made, probably every 5 to 7 years, they're going to use someone else. So if you're anchoring your entire business model on, there's my clients for life, they know me, they like me, they trust me. What happens when their sister-in-law gets their license in 2 years from now when they decide to sell a house and you're not the closest relationship they have? That brings me to this point. Most agents get chosen for representation based on the emotion of guilt. Most consumers
feel bad if I don't use this
man,
person.
Man, who we want to use? Man, I feel bad if we don't use such and such.
Hilarious.
So most agents, you may know, like, and trust, but they know 6 or 7 other people. Which one would they feel the most guilty not using? And you're going to spend the next several years glad handing, shaking hands, kissing babies, emailing, nurture sequence, all the stuff that you're doing. You may never have a shot at the relationship because of the relationship of guilt. So wouldn't you rather be more valuable and have a clear, distinct, more offering versus no, like, and trust? That's manipulation in a weird way.
Right. It's this indisputable binary choice of, like, you want to represent an element of inherent value in some ways in people's minds where they say, I can either make a choice that isn't necessarily as wise, or I can choose this person that's clearly represented themselves as capable and valuable, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that's really interesting. I can attest that guilt does play into the decision.
Big decision.
And that's That is an uncomfortable truth that I think probably needs to be said a little louder for the folks in the back.
So when you prioritize like how you're going to build your business, I don't want to say like I've lowered the priority of know, like, and trust. I've just ranked higher as like create value. And, you know, for me, it comes around value innovation, which I could have never done at traditional legacy companies as that before. I can't innovate around value for my customer. And if for me, value is kind of like this inversion of how can I reduce and eliminate cost, Netflix versus Comcast, reduce or eliminate cost, Uber versus the taxi driver, reduce or eliminate cost, Airbnb versus the Hilton. Like, great companies have Disney Plus, for crying out loud. I mean, good gosh, it's amazing that you can have every movie that Disney has ever done for like $10 or whatever it is. Reduce or eliminate cost and then raise and create new value, new distinctions. And so whenever you're having this overlap of reducing and eliminating costs, raising and creating value, that overlap is value innovation. And to me, for agents, you have a choice if you want to play the traditional model or you want to create value in the future of real estate. You know, Steve Jobs, at his commencement address in Stanford, he said, "This thing that we call life was created and made up by people no smarter than you." So why would you want to basically live your life in someone else's reality, someone else's world? And I'm just really just sad for the real estate community who chooses to live inside a legacy framework that is antiquated. It's misaligned with the customers. We, in a sense, still propagate a lot of the traditions that my dad had in his brokerage in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, if we're being completely honest, we've actually been doing real estate for the same way about 100 years. Or more.
If you're new to the real estate world, if you still have a roadmap ahead of you, and I'd say roadmap, if you think you're going to be in this business in 10 years, why would you not say, you know what? I want to create the future. I want to build the ideas in my head. And you know what? It seems to be like some of these things are going to work. Some of these things are not going to work, but I'm going to at least live life on my terms and not be beholden to this antiquated structure that, frankly, my friends and family are like, this doesn't work for me. This is not working for me. There are like, our reputation as an industry is down there with like used car salesmen now. I mean, seriously, like, we just don't have that great of a reputation because of the ease in which someone can get into. There is zero accountability. You can absolutely suck at your job as a real estate agent, and your brokerage will aid and abet weak and uncommitted agents. It's maddening. So like, I level up agents, like associations, level up, like raise the standard. Like, this is embarrassing. The consumers deserve better.
Yes.
So for some agents, if you're offended by this, I don't really care. If you're offended by it, get better. I mean, I've been doing this for too long. And as I see people come to the industry, it's like, oh my gosh, I'll use an example. The top 100 Instagram influencers for real estate was released last year for the state of Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
I was on a trip and I was really bored. So I just started like at number one, going through and looking up their sales numbers to see how they've done. And it's like, wow, you have 86,000 followers and you sold 4 houses and you've been in business for 7 years. There's somebody in mind that's the case. And I'm thinking, you don't have enough reps and at-bats to do enough volume of work to create competency. So why don't you stop focusing on your style and your image and focus on substance of like, I'm going to create value. Maybe I have to discount my services. Maybe I have to like come down to where the people want me to be, but I'm going to bank as many transactions as I possibly can and have as many reps as I possibly can and be in the trenches as many hours I possibly can day in and day out. Because when I emerge on the other side of this in 2 or 3 years, I have thousands of hours, hundreds and hundreds of transactions. I have developed some bit of competency that I can freaking deliver for anybody who comes in my future. Like, I feel like your future customer deserves you to get battle hardened and be more capable. There were several years ago that I stepped away from sales and I started to look to succeed through my team and through other agents and see, you know, help them to do. And so I stepped away from sales and started to teach on what I know, not necessarily what I'm doing, but I had been through the trenches. I had gotten my 10,000 hours. I had done, you know, a very large volume of transactions. And so just being in a different role now, in supportive role, I see a different aspect of transactions. It's like, man, we have to get better. The association's not going to make us get better. The licensing at Trek is not going to make us better. The brokerages are definitely not going to make us better. I think that if there's anybody who listens, it's like, you know what? I'm going to be in real estate in 5 or 10 years from now. I want to elevate and I want to become more valuable and I want to offer something more distinctive to my customer versus just rely on the emotion of guilt, which is a form of manipulation. I actually want to be a part of what the future looks like in its creation versus just hanging on to the Titanic and this legacy model that is not in alignment with the customer's needs nowadays. I'll give you an example. The Federal Reserve, I was tinkering around on the Federal Reserve back in the early 2000s, 2000, when I first bought my first house. The average house in America, federal, if you go to Fred.com, St. Louis, it's going to, you can look at these amazing national statistics. And it showed that the average house in America was right at $200,000. Okay, that's 6%, 12,000 bucks. Well, then by like year 2020, we're like 400,000. So now you can make 24,000 in the legacy model. Now we're like at 550, just 4 years later.
Holy cow.
What are we doing consummate to the what we're charging? We had nothing to do with that 24-year rise, but we're getting paid more than double what we did back then. But yet we have DocLoop, DocuSign. Like we had these things that we can, I used to get wet signatures and we had to drive around town getting wet signatures. I used to have a desk phone. I didn't have a, I remember the first time like there was a mobile phone that this is going to change my life. I remember I got the first Toshiba laptop and I would go to Panera Bread and Starbucks because I could work in the field.
Oh yeah.
Versus I had to go to the office and sit at the desk. Like technology has made life so much more efficient for the agent, but that technology has not, there is no advantage in pass down of cost savings or time efficiency for the consumer. If anything, it has made the gap of like the agent can be more efficient with their time and they can make geometrically more money to no benefit to the consumer. There's still an expectation of you're paying 6%, 5% commission. And agents would say, oh, be careful of the discount brokerages. Be careful of the fee for service. Like you're going to get what you pay for. There's scare tactics around that. To me, the word discount, wait, discounting from what?
So right. I take exception with discount. It's not intrinsic value.
You're admitting that there's a standard by which it's being discounted from, and standardization is a monopoly. This antitrust violation. So when people use the word discount, it's like, you're actually admitting that there is a standardized monopoly, that there is antitrust potential issues. And that's why there's all these lawsuits today. That's why the consumers in the hundreds of thousands have banded together and said, we're going to have class action lawsuits against our friends and family, the realtors, are the ones that we know, like, and trust, because we feel like we've gotten screwed. And the agent community wants to tell them why they're wrong versus they want to listen and say, tell me more. Help me understand where you're coming from. Practicing empathy.
Know, like, and trust is really unique in the service world to this sort of subset in real estate, because which other industry has the ability to only work with the people that they know? There are so many service industries that rely on the general public, strangers. Yeah. And so you learn that a stranger doesn't care enough about you if you are poor in presenting your value or actualizing your service value. And so in some ways, you talk about being battle-hardened. Strangers force you to have a business plan. Strangers force you to have great branding that's cohesive and is stable. Strangers force you to be able to deliver a regularized, high-quality product. And so it's really interesting, this know, like, and trust. It does begin to lull us into having a relational connectivity to our folks that transact with us that almost covers over, accidentally or on purpose, sins of practice.
And or you don't have to be valuable.
Like, well, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I mean, just be the, like when we went, we flipped our company to fee for service in 2000, I literally got with peripheral friends, friends that I just don't see on a regular basis. I met with them. I said, hey, I'm not going to take you out to coffee, take you out to lunch, create an artificial friendship with you over time just to keep the jig up in hopes that you use my company down the road. I can't do that. I've got four young kids I got to spend time with. So you're probably not going to hear from me like you used to in the olden days when I'm no like and trust in you. And I said, but I'm going to shoot you straight. You will not find a better value proposition and you will not find a better service offering in this city, period. So remember that whenever you come to the point in which you're ready to make a decision. I offer the best service and the best customer value proposition. In no uncertain terms, here's my menu of services and here's the cost I associate with it. I have had so many people like, hey, I remember that conversation that you had 2.5 years
ago.
You
shot me straight.
We got friends that are in real estate, but this, listen, I remembered it. It's best for my family. And I've had people like, you know, we're choosing to work with a company in a system of service. The company's delivering the value versus an independent contractor who may get sick. They may be on vacation. They may have other clients that they're prioritizing. We can't be at the whim of an independent contractor just because we're friends, because honestly, if we're friends, we should still be friends at the end of this. We're choosing a company to execute based on a checklist, based on a process, not an independent contractor based on relational strength.
A lot of the service world must steel itself and galvanize into a regularized process, standards of practice, repeatable production quality for their service or good because the market requires it.
They demand it. They say, I will only buy your good or service if you meet my need.
Right. And we begin to trust companies over people. That has 100%. Been a really interesting trend over the last 200 years of American business. And so there is an inverse paradigm, certainly still present in real estate, where individual personality brands are sort of elevated, interestingly enough, over what sometimes is termed like a clinical or like a company identity, because we're still relying on this relational connectivity over sort of intrinsic service quality. And you can point to what quality looks like. In fact, if we begin to move outside of the traditional real estate paradigm and look, say, at other industries. Who's negotiating contracts? Who's helping understand like price and cost basis? Who's understanding like the speed and the movement of repair or, you know, of management of a product to go to market? If we look at all that things and we borrow the costs associated with those little blocks in other industries, then what you begin to stack up is a value, a cost of conveying real estate that is quite a bit different than the current percentages and commissions and stuff like that. And so I'm not saying we should go that direction or we shouldn't, but
customer choice.
It is interesting that if the customers were able to break real estate down into its essential building blocks, like the DNA almost, if you will, and then go to other industries and look for those DNA sort of markers and then rebuild their own little version of it, which I kind of think is what the technological disruption, the grander disruption that's happening with Opendoor and Zillow and, you know, these hundreds of people. If they're rebuilding it in their minds, then it comes in at a lower basis. And I think that the voice of the people, the Vox Populi, has said, we are uncomfortable with this in our gut. We don't exactly know why we're uncomfortable with it, but we want a different paradigm.
That would be true for the financial services industry several years ago, whenever people were like, why am I paying you a percentage of my assets under management?
Right.
If we lose money, we pay a percentage. If we make money, we pay a percentage. That makes no sense. And so, you know, Vanguard was maybe one of the earlier ones to start to move towards
fee-based.
The industry did not like it at all. Well, I worked with a financial planner the other day who came to our company. They're working with our agents, and I was talking to him. He goes, man, we lost the ability as an industry to charge the way y'all have traditionally charged several years ago. It's only a matter of time till the market will force you to come and do fee for service.
Here we are in market correction. It's not just price of homes. It's price of service. It's so much of that is applicable here. And the truth is, our original supposition at the beginning here, we didn't really even get to, and that is innovation and setting yourself apart is one of the only constants in being able to be relevant and support ongoing value, aka pricing. And so if we're not being innovators, then we will eventually fall behind the sort of the trending and that float line that you're talking about. And innovation at its core is looking around at everything that's going on around you, looking at the trending of how long these things have been popular or have been going on, and saying, What's not happening? Where are the spaces and the voids, the market? When everybody's zigging, when do I need to be zagging? And that in this larger brandscape, so much white noise. We're not just all watching the big black and white telly anymore. We've got just so much assault, email marketing and social media and everything on that's going on in our ears, that the only way to set yourself apart as a practitioner, as a service professional, is to be able to be intelligently looking at the landscape and saying, what values everybody else provide? And then what am I overlapped and what am I departing from and how do I promote that?
Yeah. What's your points of difference?
Yes. I would love to have you back so we can get into innovation, where Scout has been continuing to make departures in the market, what the pushback and the reality in a very difficult old framework system, and kind of what's the next thing in the forefront. Jonathan, my goodness, amazing conversation.
Yeah,
if your veins, listeners, are not on fire right now and excited to go out and practice your profession in a better and new and innovative manner, you have not been listening. You got to start at the beginning and try again. Thank you, Jonathan. We'll have you back. Guys, I'm Michael Conrad. This has been the Business of Homes podcast. We'd love to have you hit subscribe, join us wherever you're listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Hey everyone, Jake again, director for the Business of Homes podcast. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. A huge thank you to Jonathan Harris for being a part of the podcast. Go follow him on Instagram at Jonathan Allen Harris and let him know how much you enjoyed their story. Don't forget to subscribe on your preferred listening platform and make sure to follow us as well on Instagram at The Business of Homes Pod. Do you have any feedback or want to suggest someone for the show? Email us at thebusinessofhomespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you soon.